The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
One small
not
step for man.
Easy,
we have main engine
hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you're having a nice sort of unofficial holiday weekend, because the holiday is actually Tuesday, but in a way it still is a holiday weekend for July 4th. Happy birthday to the United States, if you're listening, and everybody else out there as well. And we have a great show planned for you today with Michael Listener. Let's get into and quickly through announcements and on to our show. For those of you who would like to call Michael, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we will answer it and bring you up on air just as quickly as we possibly can. You can also email us, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then you can comment to us directly from our blog. And to do that, go to our website, thespaceshow.com. Go all the way over to the right to upcoming shows. The Michael Listener Show is the first one listed there. And if you post a comment, just open that page and scroll down to the bottom, of course, and post away questions or comments. And they come right to me, and I will integrate them into the show as quickly as possible. So those are the three ways to reach us, but the priority way, the preferred way, is our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And we already have our website newsletter posted for the coming week. So it is up on the spaceshow.com site. Make sure you scroll down to see all of the shows that we have planned. We've added a few shows since the last time. And note also, there will be no show on the actual holiday, July 4th. So that is the only day this week we're giving a pass to live programming. Our Hotel Mars show is already identified. NEOs, asteroids, how close can they come? David Grinspoon is our guest again. And we may have an additional guest as well. That is still to be decided. So the website newsletter is already up and running. Remember, everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our site and easily download and quickly download our shows. The Space Show store, for those of you interested in coffee mugs or T-shirts or something with the Space Show logo on it, it is in the upper left menu under support, and you'll see our store listed there. And then also, many of you, and this was especially true at the New Space Conference that I attended last week, wanted to know how do you listen to a live show, how do you listen to an archive show. So up, also in that upper left menu, there is Listen Live, and that has all the instructions for listening to a live show as well as an archive show. And then on the right, center right, is the Support the Space Show information. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. Your support keeps the Space Show on the air. So we thank those of you who do financially support us. We're deeply appreciative of that. Remember, your gifts are tax deductible if you're paying federal taxes. And if you're paying California taxes, since we're a California public benefit corporation, your gift is deductible in California as well. And if you have any questions, visit our parent, which is a 501c3, 1-O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And again, we thank you very much for your support. I know I say this all the time, but it is the truth. Without your support, there simply will not be a Space Show program. So it is very important to us and to those of you who want to continue to listen to the Space Show. We also have sponsors, corporate sponsors, for the Space Show. Their banner ads run across the Space Show homepage. Click on them from time to time. The sponsors do change their messages underneath those banner ads. And I read a short segment, or I guess promo would be better than say segment, from our sponsors. And we also have a new sponsor that we're promoting now that I picked up at the New Space Conference. So, again, we're thankful to the Integrated Space Plan. They're a sponsor for the first segment of our program. Remember, this is a detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space, and the plan includes Earth-to-orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. And visit their website, thespaceplan.com, for all the details. You can view their online plan, and it's got about 500 elements in it, so you can click on those, and they expand into lots more information. You can also buy a copy of the Integrated Space Plan as a poster, and it's full size. Very cool. All of this available at thespaceplan.com. And then the Space Foundation is a sponsor, and again, they run these fabulous programs called the Symposiums each year. The 34th Symposium is up and running and is going to be April 16th through the 19th, again in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor. And their website for this is spacesymposium.org. Totally different people than you would meet at a space advocate type of conference or a new space conference. Lots of incredibly great and different, and I do mean different, networking opportunities, new people to meet. So hopefully you can attend to the 34th Symposium, again, April 16th through the 19th of 2018. And our new sponsor is the New Worlds Conference. This is the conference started several years ago by Rick Tumlinson. It is in Austin, Texas, November 10th through the 11th. And it's already got some really great featured speakers, Gersta Meyer from NASA, Rick Tumlinson again, Pete Warden, Bob Zubrin, and a lot of others to come out. So it's at the Renaissance Hotel, Austin, Texas, November 10th through the 11th. I plan on being there. And if you want to check it out, go to New Worlds. So there's two W's there, N-E-W-W-O-R-D, and then Worlds, it's plural, New Worlds 2017. .space. That's a domain, I guess, now, space. So check it out, and we thank them for sponsorship. And our guest today, as I said a few minutes ago, was Michael Listener. So Michael is a really talented attorney and space attorney. He is the founder and principal of Space Law and Policy Solutions, which is a think tank and consultation firm concentrating on legal and space policy matters for outer space security, industry, development. He has a Bachelor of Science in Computer Information Systems from Franklin Pierce University, and he has his JD or law degree from Regent University School of Law, and he's a member of the New Hampshire Bar. And it's great to welcome Michael back to the show. You know, Michael, at New Space, the Minister of Economics for Luxembourg was a keynote speaker. And maybe he'll come on the show. I mean, you know, he came all the way to San Francisco to speak to 100 people, so who knows. But there also was a group of the economic department out of Portugal for the Azores, because they are trying to develop what they think would be the best spaceport possible for Europe and maybe other places as well. And I talked with them at length about their plans at one of the cocktail receptions. And they had a whole team there from the Azores, about three or four people. I mean, that's a lot of money for Portugal to send over here. Very, very interested in space and commercial space. And, of course, I know from other conferences, UAE gets present, Abu Dhabi gets present. And there were people at the conference from New Zealand that I haven't seen before, and they're excited about what's going on in space in New Zealand. Michael, it sounds like regardless of what policy may be, or maybe because of policy, aspects of commercial space are going viral.
Well, I think that's one way of putting it. I mean, there's definitely a lot going on in the world, so much so that there's, you know, it's really hard to keep up with it. And this is where you get like a 61-page quarterly issue, like I put out last Wednesday from my briefing letter. It's going big, and you know, you mentioned New Zealand, which is good because they are very close to actually making their domestic space law actually law. It's like in the final stages right now in their parliament before it gets actually signed into law. So they're very close with it. It's going on all over the place, and I've seen Kenya has a space agency now. Egypt's considering creating a space agency. So it's going on everywhere because everybody understands that, you know, the future is having a stakehold in outer space activities, whether, you know, it just isn't Russia, China, and the United States anymore. It's countries all over the world with different levels of economic worth.
So the other thing I met there, and this ties into your legal work as well, were guys that are running commercial businesses of ground stations for SmallSat and CubeSat satellite control and data reception transmission back to Earth. And so I made the comment to them, and they told me they're putting them in all over the world, in Africa and parts of Europe, and they mentioned different African countries and South America. And, I mean, literally, they're putting these ground stations in lots and lots of places. And I said, I guess it's a hell of a lot easier and cheaper to put them there than to, say, try to put them in California or a place in the U.S. with environmental impact reports and taxes and fees and, you know, different reports and different building codes and all that. And he says, no, it's the same. It is so evolved as a source of revenue for the governments that they have the same kind of fee structure, licensing structure, permit structure, with the same horrible bureaucracy that the United States have. Each one of them said they don't gain very much in terms of eliminating fees and licensing structure and bureaucracy. Just because they're going to put a ground station in Africa, they still have communication rules to follow. They all have their own version of FCC, even if it's primitive, and they have to obey the licensing rules for that country and the telecommunication rules. So there isn't a spot, I guess, that is regulatory free.
Well, I mean, I think the whole regulatory free thing is wishful thinking. I mean, it's basically looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It just isn't there. And, you know, here in the United States, we've been, you know, the new space community is apoplectic whenever you talk about regulation. And even in the House, the House of Representatives and the Senate, the space committees on both those bodies are looking at, you know, are basically apoplectic towards, you know, the quote, regulation as a monster. But the bottom line is it's something that's going to happen because you don't only have domestic rules you have to follow, but you have international legal obligations that you have to do. Now, I know the whole international law thing, you know, we've been down this road before about whether it applies to private commercial entities. That's, you know, that's another argument altogether, but the fact of the matter is there's always going to be rules. There's always going to be regulations. The idea is, I think commercial space or private space has to evolve to meet those challenges, or at least meet the government halfway when it comes to that type of when it comes to rules and regulations and laws that have to be followed.
My take, after talking to the CEOs of these companies doing turnkey satellite communication type of operations, is they, as a business, are meeting these rules and complying with the laws and regulations, and they are very specific that they don't gain much by being in a foreign country over the regulatory and fee and licensing process and doing something, say, in California, which is off the chart with regulations. They said it's almost the same no matter where you go, and it's just a fact of life, and you're not going to find regulatory, license-free, no-permit fee places to go set up your businesses. So you just do what you need to do to legally operate in where it is you want to operate, whether it's in Kenya or whether it's in San Francisco.
Well, it's part of doing business. And,
right.
And then this goes for things like ITAR. You know, smaller, you know, these startup new space companies are lamenting ITAR, it's a fact of life here. And, you know, companies like Lockheed and Boeing, they understand this, and they have their own, and in that case, they have their own internal ITAR compliance specialists, but there are other sources to, in order to ensure it. Now, I've had people come to me and say, well, maybe I'll just try and sneak around, and I'm saying, well, you know what, you can try and sneak around it. Sometimes it's easier to ask and make sure that you're don't have to, you don't have anything to comply with versus trying to sneak around it, because you're just going to cause yourself more grief in the long run if you do have to comply with it and you get caught. So it's part of doing, you know, I've always found that doing business isn't, you know, I'm going to go into business to make a lot of money. There's a lot under the surface. It's kind of like an iceberg. You know, people see the tip of the iceberg and say that really looks cool. What they don't see is everything underneath that keeps that iceberg afloat, that actually keeps things moving. It's just part of doing business, and you know, as tiresome as it is, and it does cost money, but that's something you have to do in order to run a business. And the same thing goes with commercial space. It's a business, and you have to abide by the rules and regulations, and you really can't be crying about it all the time. You just got to deal with it.
Yeah, and it's present everywhere. So these guys kind of brought me into modern times, because I really thought if they were going into foreign countries because it was a lot cheaper to operate there than the United States. That's not necessarily the reason.
Well, the reason these ground stations, these ground based terminal companies are going in there is they basically need spots in order to have worldwide coverage. That's what NASA did during the space race. Is they went to countries like Australia and such, and putting ground stations to keep in constant contact with their spacecraft, so that they would, especially during the manned missions. Now we have this thing called TDRS, which basically is, you know, from geosynchronous orbit, allows NASA to have constant communication no matter where the spacecraft is. But these new companies, you know, they don't have access to TDRS or something of its equivalent, so they had to actually put in the ground stations in order to keep constant communication with the CubeSats that are up there, and the plethora of CubeSats are going to be launched in the future.
Absolutely. So it's a legal regulatory world, whether we like it or not.
It is. And, you know, as much as people hate my profession and hate what I have to do and hate what I have to say sometimes, it's reality, folks. Deal with it, and don't get upset about it. It isn't, and once you wade into it, it's manageable. Once you learn the ins and outs, it's manageable. And yes, you're gonna have to write. You're gonna have to spend some money. You may have to hire somebody to do it. You may have to hire somebody like me to do it, to help you navigate it. But you're gonna get to your destination, and standing there and complaining about it isn't going to get you there.
One of them is putting in ground stations in Russia. And so the good news is they're not being investigated for screwing up our election by the House or Senate yet. But the other news is it's just as regulatory and expensive as it is in the United States. They're not picking up any slack for operating in Russia.
Well, it's a simple matter that, you know, they're looking at, you know, they're looking at this. These are companies that are going to come in here and make a lot of money. Why should we give them a break? And why shouldn't they abide by our rules and regulations? They want to do business. They're just like any other business. They have to abide by our rules and regulations.
Right.
And oh yes, they're probably going to have to pay our taxes too. They may get some tax breaks by going into these other countries, but they still have to abide by the rules. The rules do apply to everybody.
Well, moving on, what's new from your perspective? You did do a 70-plus page pre-sys a couple of days
61.
ago. 61. Well, felt like 161.
Tell me, I had to go soak my head in a sink full of cold water after that one. That was a lot. I mean, it surprised me how much was going on when I sat down at the beginning of the month and really started pulling it together. Actually, I should say the beginning of June, started pulling it together. There's a lot out there, and even towards the end of putting it together, more stuff was popping up. There's a lot of legislation going on, and I'm going to start from the bottom. Instead of starting at the federal, I'm going to go right to the state, because there's one big thing on the state.
Okay.
Georgia passed a state, its Commercial Space Space Flight Act a few months ago, and the governor signed it into law, and it officially took effect yesterday on July 1st. So they now have a limited liability law. And to tack on to that, and similar to that, the FAA is currently reviewing their application for Camden Spaceport. And that's probably a year or so down the road. There are going to be environmental assessments and some other things that the FAA will have to wade through and look at before they'll get a license to actually make it an official spaceport and then pour that concrete slab that will start off their official, quote, spaceport.
It's actually in a good location. They can even do orbital flights from there.
Yeah, well, you know, you can do orbital flights from anywhere. I mean, but it's easier from that neck of the woods because it's, you know, it takes less energy. And I'm not going to try and get too technical because I'm not very fluent in it, but it takes less energy to get a rocket into an orbit from, say, Florida or Georgia. But, yeah, they're working on it. Now, the funny thing is Alabama, their next-door neighbor, was, I don't know if they passed the legislation, but they were supposed to pass legislation that was supposed to create a study group to create a spaceport. And kind of one of the leverage that the Georgia House of Assembly, in fact, the gentleman who actually sponsored this in the Georgia House, basically says, hey, if we don't get this all on the books first, Alabama's going to beat us to the punch, and, you know, there would be no sense for us creating a spaceport if they create one. So now that Georgia actually has their law on the book, and if they get their spaceport license, you know, it's questionable whether Alabama will follow through and do their own.
Well, Georgia abuts up to the Atlantic, and they can fly out east over the ocean with a minimum impact of a debris field. Alabama doesn't have that privilege, so debris field issues on an orbital flight for Alabama will be much more of a critical issue.
Well, I think basically, I know Georgia's looking mainly, they're going to be at vertical launches. They have vector space systems that's supposedly going to be
Well, that's where the market is right now, obviously.
Yeah, and I mean, Alabama might be good for, you know, a glide and landing from, you know, from a Virgin Galactic, from an X-Corp, from a Sierra Nevada. But those companies have really yet to fly. Well, Vector has been doing some test flights right
now. Well, yeah, so. And they just got a lot of money in. So
yeah, they just got a big $21 million surge of money from private investment, which is good for them because it'll definitely help them along. But bottom line, you know, the idea is, you know, this idea of spaceports is taking off a lot in the United States. Well, Colorado is looking to tack on a spaceport license to one of its existing airports as well. And I know Sierra Nevada has expressed interest in maybe using that for their Dream Chaser if and when it actually becomes operational.
Which one do they want?
That would be just a horizontal landing site. I don't think they'd be able to do any vertical launches from there.
What airport do they want to tack it on to?
Oh, I don't have it right at tip of my tongue, but if you Google Colorado spaceport, boom, it'll come up, and they even have their own website. I think I mentioned it in my issue too. You know, basically what's going on with that, and that's something I'll be covering over, you know, for the duration until, you know, something comes up here. And I know they're about a year; they figure about a year out from the FAA making a final decision on whether or not they will get their spaceport license packed onto their airport license.
Well, everyone wants one. We'll see if the market evolves to support them all.
Well, that, bottom line is, I think with small satellites, there is potentially a market. I really see a big proliferation and the need for small sat launchers. And I think these dedicated small sat launchers have a huge opportunity in the next 5 to 10 years to really, you know, corner the market and keep themselves flying versus, you know, some like SpaceX or ULA who, you know, will basically fly your small sats, but on their schedule versus, you know, and they'll have more, these smaller companies will have more flexibility in their schedule and almost be, say, we can basically launch when you need to and go from there. So it's definitely a different niche market, but I think it has a lot of potential in the next few years.
What do you think of the Azores? Have you looked at that yet? I mean, I was surprised to see them at the New Space Conference.
I haven't even looked at them yet. I mean, like I said, there is so much out there and so much that I've been researching and analyzing and digesting. I just haven't covered it all. And basically the Azores, it's something just like Africa. Africa, I know, is developing a space policy and a space strategy. I've mentioned it, but I haven't really delved into it and looked at it to see what's going on with it. That's something I'm going to put down maybe a couple months from now. But they're working on it too, and they're taking it from a whole continent a continent approach that all the nations in Africa are going to pool together and develop the strategy to make Africa, you know, very prominent in outer space as well.
Interesting world.
It really is, and I think, you know, I think everybody is understanding that, you know, they gotta get involved somehow or get left behind. They probably all won't be creating manned space programs, which are extremely expensive, but they're gonna have satellites eventually, whether it's even CubeSats, and they're gonna go for it. In fact, Finland has its first satellites in orbit, last year, they put their first two CubeSats in orbit, both on two separate launches. So they now have their first spacecraft, and they're developing a space law on top of it. So it's busy. It's really busy out there. But bottom line is, you know, all the rockets and tech stuff is great, but fundamentally you got to start at the beginning, and you got to develop the policy, the laws, and then the regulations on how you're going to actually do this and comply with not only what your country needs, but also what the international community demands.
What stands out in terms of some of the policy and the issues you've been looking at?
Right now, I've been watching a lot on the U.S. side, because we've been doing a lot of unusual things with space. The House Committee on Space has been very active. They just passed this thing called the House Committee itself passed what's called H.R. 2809, the American Space Commerce Free Enterprise Act, and I'm not a fan. It's very concerning for a number of reasons, but essentially what it does, it takes away any authorization capabilities the FAA has, except for, you know, a launch license and a reentry license, take it away from the FAA, and they give it to the Department of Commerce, to an entity within there. And they're going to imbue that organization, that one department, with powers to authorize or deny the ability to fly a mission. Say I want to do a space debris removal mission. Well, in order to get that done, I'm going to have to go through this Commerce Department and check off the boxes that, you know, I'm not carrying nuclear weapons, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. And they're going to get a yay or nay, and from there, they're going to have to get a launch license from the FAA in order to launch it. So it's kind of taking everything away, taking a big portion away from the FAA and creating it in what I think is going to be a new bureaucracy. Now, this is supposed to streamline things, make it more commerce-minded versus transportation-minded. But what really bugs me about the whole thing is we take this whole thing about, you know, commercial space activities. I've always put them out that, you know, it's just like getting a driver's license. You know, you have a privilege to drive a car if you can meet certain requirements, but you don't have a right to drive a car. In other words, you can't go into court and say I have a constitutional right to drive a car, because you don't. What this is, and I think space, you know, space, outer space activities are the same way, based on, you know, our legal commitments to the Outer Space Treaty and such. That it is a privilege that the country like the United States has a right to grant a privilege of commercial space activities to its non-governmental citizens, but they don't have a fundamental right to do it. So basically, what this does is, and this is Congressman Babin. This has been kind of his, you know, his bailiwick, you know, that space, you know, the space activities are a right. And with this new law that the House is going to take up, it's basically going to turn commercial space activities into a right versus a private interest.
What's the name of this bill again?
It is called the American Space Commerce Free Enterprise Act. It's very long, and it does a lot of things. It actually takes some requirements under the FAA for communication, for space remitigation, that's under the FAA rules and under the NOAA rules, and puts them under the cover of this warrant organization. Now, I was able to get an initial draft of it and look it over, and I had some concerns, and I actually wrote into a contact at one of the congressman's offices, say, hey, you know, some of this is, you know, pretty concerning. But there was a lot of back and forth, and because, you know, Representative Babb does have a lot of power, and I know Representative Alexander loves this stuff too. It really got pushed through. So there's a lot. I guess my problem is, you know, this in combination with what Senator Cruz is doing with, I know he's had multiple hearings on free enterprise and outer space for private individuals and companies. I'm really kind of concerned that we're so concerned about what international, you know, how international law affects our commercial entities. I'm more concerned about how we change the law to make things more make things more friendly here will affect international law versus, so in other words, instead of international, how international law affects, you know, the United States citizens and their commercial space activities, we're focusing so much on that, and we're not really paying attention to how changes in law, like the American Space Commerce Free Enterprise Act, might affect international obligation, not only international obligations, but how it might shape international law. Now, bottom line is, this thing is supposed to make the United States, quote, more competitive. And I tell people, it's like, you know what, this is probably the best place in the world to do private space activities. We are a premier space power. Yeah, we got to jump through some hoops. You got to jump through some hoops to do it. But we've been doing this for a while. And in fact, all the nations that have adopted domestic space laws, for the most part, have looked at the FAA model and they've adopted it. And now we're getting ready to change it. And then I told somebody one time that a lot of countries are going to be scratching their heads saying, "What the heck are we up to?" And you know, what are we upsetting the apple cart all of a sudden? So this is something that still has to be passed by the House as a general, and then it has to be reconciled in the Senate. Given Senator Cruz's enthusiasm, I am sure this will. I am very likely get passed when it's put into some sort of merger out of the bill. So it's going to be an adventure. I think it's going to be interesting. I'm just very uncomfortable with it. And to be honest, I really don't think it's necessary. I really don't think it's necessary.
This is HR 2809.
Yes.
So your newsletter mentions Lamar Smith in it. So has he got a strong role in this?
Yes, he does. I believe he's a chairman actually of the House Science. House Science and Technology and Space Committee.
Uh-huh.
He's actually the chair, and Representative Babin is actually the chair of the subcommittee on space. And between the two of them, they really love space. I mean, I know they had a couple years back they had Andy Weir as quote a witness, and they couldn't wait to get their copies of the book, The Martian, signed and autographed by him. They've been really pushing. In fact, I know there was one Democrat on that committee that she spoke out and she tried to create an amendment that would keep these functions within the FAA and give the FAA what we call on-orbit authority. But she withdrew it after she found it she didn't have the votes. And Representative Smith was pretty a little bit terse, you know, in his admonishing her for even suggesting that, you know, that we should keep those responsibilities with the FAA and not create this new, for lack of a better term, bureaucracy in the Commerce Department.
What's the timeline on a proposed legislation like this?
You probably won't see something until the end of summer after they come back from recess. I know Senator Cruz wants to create a new space competitiveness bill to actually build upon the 2015. Bill that was passed into law. So this will probably become part of that. This has still got to be passed by the House, and it's still got to go to the Senate, which means the Senate Committee on Science, on Space Science and Competitiveness will have to take it up as well and pass it and recommend it on to the full Senate. So I think this will become part of a larger bill, a larger commercial space bill. So you probably won't see anything, this actually getting signed into law probably around November or so, depending on the legislative schedule.
That seems like a pretty big change.
It's a huge change, and I think I look at things from a larger version of international law, and because it's just such a if I were to compare law to algebra, international law would be calculus. It's a lot more complex. It's a lot more abstract. It's a lot more uncertain. What's going to happen. You know, if you make a change here, because basically we've been doing this whole commercial space thing a certain way and treating it as kind of a private interest ever since President Reagan signed his National Space Policy in 1982 and we had the first Commercial Space Launch Act in 1984. We've been treating it as a private interest. Now, after 30 years, or more than 30 years actually, we are turning around, we're treating it as a right. So So how that's going to affect our, you know, how is it going to affect Article 6 is questionable. And at the same time, if this whole thing is about making, you know, America more competitive, it could also have the opposite effect and make us less competitive, too.
How would that happen?
Well, basically, if we say, well, you know, you don't have to be as stringent on the requirements in order to authorize and supervise in Article 6, other countries, if that gets picked up as a customary interpretation of what authorize and supervise means in Article 6, other countries are going to say, you know what, we don't have to do all these stringent regulations because the U.S. isn't doing them. We're going to throw a lot of them out, and we're going to strip it down to bare bones and make it more, more appealing for companies to come here and launch their rockets from our nation versus, say, the United States. And this is something, you know, it's kind of like it's a snowball effect. We can, and those unintended consequences, the potential that this idea of creating a more competitive environment could actually backfire and make it a less competitive environment in the long run.
Give us another monumental potential change.
In the Space Act, I know there is a definition of space object, which is defined in both the Liability Convention and I believe it is the Registration Convention. And there is a specific international definition of what space object is. Now, back in 1979, when Cosmos 9, that Russian satellite, nuclear-powered satellite 949, I think it was, crashed in the Canadian wilderness, the Canadian government invoked the Liability Convention. And they said, they went to the Soviet embassy and they said, this is your spacecraft, it's caused contamination, we're invoking Article 2, the strict liability standard of the Liability Convention. And the Soviets came back and said, but it's not a spacecraft anymore, it's just wreckage. And they tried to weasel out of it. The Canadians, to their credit, pushed back and say, no, according to the Liability Convention, according to the definition in Article 1 of the Liability Convention, a spacecraft consists of either the spacecraft herself and or its component parts. What this law will do is it will basically come out and define anything within the spacecraft as not a space object. In other words, a spacesuit, an occupant, or a payload wouldn't be considered a space object. So how do you reconcile that with international law, the definition found in international law, especially when it concerns a payload? That could have a very fundamental effect on international law, because we can create this thing called customary international law, which is law that is made through the actions of states, and we have a lot of muscle when it comes to that. We could fundamentally change the definition of what a space object is through this law, and do that from what we call the bottom up through a domestic law that would affect international law in the long term. I think it's very disturbing, just because I don't think it was well thought out, to be honest. I mean, I'm looking at this and just doesn't seem very well thought out what the long-term international effects could be.
Will that survive the negotiation over the bill?
Well, it survived the committee markup, so it's still there. Another one that I found really kind of made me do a double take and just a little bit of a sigh was there's this one provision within the bill that specifically comes out and say, notwithstanding any other law, outer space will not be considered a global commons. I'm not sure what that means. I'm not entirely sure what that's referring to, whether it might be a poke at the Moon Treaty, which we don't even recognize as binding international law, or is it a poke at the Outer Space Treaty that basically says this is not a that space is the province of all mankind, res communis. I mean, if it's taking a poke at the Outer Space Treaty, in other words, you know, treating the Outer Space Treaty as, you know, the whole res communis concept as null and void, for lack of a better term, that could be very fundamentally shattering and controversial, because in essence you're basically just denying that fundamental principle of the Outer Space Treaty. I don't have a lot of clarification on what that little provision means, but it wasn't, the important thing was it wasn't couched in a sense of Congress type of statement. In other words, a statement that would say, well, it's just, you know, our opinion. It basically blatantly came out and said that, you know, notwithstanding any of the law, space will not be considered a global commons. could have significant impacts. Again, I don't know if that's something that the State Department might actually look at and say, no, you can't do that, because that would go against the Outer Space Treaty, and you can't have it. So I'm sure the State Department is definitely going to get a crack at this and look it over and point out any problems with it before, you know, the House will vote on it.
Why wouldn't it just be a poke at countries and people that want to claim space as a global common for their own political purpose and their own political agenda, rather than poking at the treaties?
Well, I think the way I'm reading it is basically a poke at this treaty itself, versus this whole idea that nobody can own space, nobody can claim sovereign control over space. I mean, I don't understand. I'm not really sure why that provision's in there. I think it might be geared more towards individuals, saying individuals can own, say, an asteroid or the moon or whatever. I don't know. There isn't a lot of clarification. I think the lack of clarification there is not a good thing, and that's something that I'm sure the State Department will ask a lot of questions about. At least I hope they'll ask a lot of questions about.
Okay.
I mean, because fundamentally, you know, the whole thing, you know, I know Senator Cruz had this hearing that I actually submitted testimony to, and it actually got entered in, thanks to one of my senators here in New Hampshire, about whether we should withdraw or amend from the Outer Space Treaty. And there were two panels. There were lawyers first, and then there were representatives from the commercial space industry. And both sides says, no, we don't need to amend or withdraw from the Outer Space Treaty. But when you start promoting bills like the one we're talking about right now, some of these things, you know, even though you aren't changing the words of the Outer Space Treaty, you're changing their meaning. And that fundamentally, in my book, is, hey, that's kind of, you know, amendment, and you're amending it through customary law versus actually altering the words of the treaty. In other words, changing what the words mean versus changing the words themselves.
You know, Michael, this brings me back, and so I kind of like that language, although I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know the legal ramification of when I did interviews with radio stations that said space is a global commons, so keep your damn commercial hands off of it. And of course, these were the radio interviewers or other people on a panel that I was on, and they were citing space as a global commons to make sure that nobody could do commercial business or make money in space or do anything private there. So to me, to say that space is not a global commons, it's a poke at these people that want to prevent space commerce from happening or from private people doing something in space. Maybe it's the same thing that you're saying, and given that I'm not an attorney, I don't make the connection. But I kind of like the idea of poking these people in the face.
Yeah, see, the provision is just very inflammatory to me, and I don't understand the context. None of my contacts in Washington or on that committee have reached out to me to explain it to me either. On the other hand, I haven't asked them about it, so I mean, I guess there's a little touche there.
Well, your assignment for the next time you're on the space show.
Yeah, if I have the inclination, I'm sometimes I just look at these things and shake my head and say, okay, whatever, you know, we'll watch it and see what happens. And you know what, if it works out, it's great. If not, I'll pop a bowl of popcorn and watch the fireworks. Sometimes I just, you know, you say, you know, there's only so much you can do, and whether or not people are going to listen to you or not is up in the air. I will say that, you know, one certain congressman did listen to some of my concerns and suggestions, and actually incorporated into the on another bill, on another piece of legislation, and actually incorporated on this one. So I was pretty pleased about that. But I mean, a friend and I were actually talking a couple weeks ago on Skype, and we were chatting back and forth about you know, some of the silliness in new space, and we were talking about this piece of legislation, and he was talking about basically the UK law in general. And, you know, one of the things that he said was, you know, the problem with the UK law is, instead of the international lawyers getting in there and drafting it, the regulators have drafted it. Well, this is exactly what's happened here. You have regulators and not people versed in international law who have drafted this law. So they really haven't, in my opinion, haven't taken into account the how this could affect international law, and then potentially bounce back on us in the future. So that's kind of one of my gripes about it. And actually, this isn't just me talking. I have several colleagues who have discussed this. My good friend and colleague Mark Sundahl actually wrote a piece in Space News, kind of poking at this and raising the concern that this bill as written may not actually allow us to meet our international legal obligations and such. So I'm not the only one out here who has concerns. I know the industry has some concerns about it, because basically they are questionable whether this new office is going to be able to actually provide, gather the necessary information, national security, environmental, and other things, in order to properly authorize it. But I analogize this bill to kind of like the whole flat tax idea. You can basically do your taxes on a postcard, which we all know is going to be is silliness. That's probably never going to happen. I think this is basically the flat tax of commercial space legislation. In other words, they want to try and do everything really, just quick lickety split and get people moving on their way. I mean, another analogy I made is basically, because it's a right, basically, it's basically saying, you have a right to a pilot's license, and we're going to look at it to make sure that you have a right to a pilot's license. But if we don't get back to you in a certain time period, we're going to give you the pilot's license anyways.
We're almost halfway through the show. Let's move on. What other legislation has your interest piqued?
I really liked, what was it? I'm looking here. It was actually a good bill that was actually co-sponsored by Representative Posey, and it dealt with Spaceflight Training and Astronaut Reform Act, H.R. 2571. I like it. Basically what this does is kind of adds on to the existing space law, and it designates certain experimental aircraft as what they call space support vehicle, and that's basically an aircraft operating at a spaceport licensed by the Federal Aviation Administration that simulates flight conditions in support of training for space flight participants or testing of spaceflight hardware. Very interesting bill. Now, some bloggers came out before this bill, the Texas bill, actually came out, and started complaining, this is a way for, groups like Virgin Galactic to fly spaceflight participants while actually getting their spacecraft certified. Nothing of the sorts. All of this does is designate certain experimental aircraft to train the spaceflight participants, and it actually distinguishes between a spaceflight support vehicle and an actual launch vehicle. In other words, a vehicle like Spaceship Two or X-Corps' vehicle or Sierra Nevada's vehicle, they're considered space launch vehicles, and as opposed to space support vehicles. So they would still have to get their certification and okie dokie from the FAA before they could fly the actual astronauts for profit. So this is more or less to help these companies that are going to do a lot of this tourism stuff to actually train their people. It's not a replacement or a means to get around the whole certification in order of spacecraft in order to fly actual spaceflight participants, and it's really good. I mean, there were a few concerns that I actually listed out in this issue again, but that I also sent to one of the congressman's office in D.C. A few comments that I made, and I'm sure they were really pleased to actually get those recommendations, and it'll be interesting to see if they actually get incorporated into the final version of the bill.
So would it be the same vehicle that they're launching into space, or would it be a different vehicle?
It might be a vehicle. Say, like, in the case of there might be separate aircraft that are designated as training aircraft. It could be a converted business jet, for example, or an aircraft like White Knight 2. If they want to fly somebody in there, to actually get them used to the idea of of flying, or for some training purposes, other training purposes, or an aircraft that's considered experimental that they want to use for, say, weightless environment simulation, then that would be considered a space support vehicle, and space flight participants would be allowed to actually go in and train on those, and not be affected by the fact that the spacecraft might not even be certified. The actual spacecraft might not even be certified. I think it's a good piece of legislation. I think there are obviously some tweaks that need to be made to it, but it's really a good idea.
And this is an HR bill, so does it have support in the Senate?
I don't know. It hasn't got over there yet.
Well, but they're aware of it, right?
It hasn't even got out of committee yet in the House. So, and after it gets out of committee, it's got to be voted on by the full House, and then it'll go over to the Senate side, and their subcommittee on space commerce and space technology and competition, they will take it up and either approve it or not. And if they approve it, it'll send it on to the full Senate to reconcile it with the House bill. But again, this is probably something you're going to see a lot of these bills that I'm mentioning. You'll probably see all these amalgamated into one big bill, just like the 2015 bill was and passed in one fell swoop.
Before we take a break, what else should we? You've got a bill here that you just say Senator McCain is back in the news with RD 180 and 181.
Yeah, there's an issue. There was a bill coming up that dealt with sanctions on Iran and Russia, and some of the wording in it was very ambiguous. And it was ambiguous enough that it could be meant to actually deny NASA from using spacecraft, using launch vehicles that use Russian-made engines. Now, we know the Atlas V is used a lot by NASA, but Russian engines are also used on the Antares rocket for orbital ATK. The idea, what happened was one of the senators basically made a presented an amendment that would have modified the language to make sure that that other language couldn't be interpreted to ban the use of the RD-180 or the RD-181 or any other Russian rocket engine for any NASA government missions. So in other words, the idea was that discrepancy, that ambiguity in the original language could have been used to prevent NASA from using an Atlas V or an Antares rocket, and that would leave just one player in town. Guess who that is?
Oh, gee. I just don't know.
Yeah, well,
it's a big mystery.
We all know, but the idea, you know, and hurt, you know, I was kind of irked me a little bit that, you know, Senator McCain was complaining about it, and he was complaining that ULA's lobbyists for ULA, and he didn't refer to them by name, but he referred to them from Orbital, lobbied against this, and I just came out and said, you know what, you got to cover both sides. I'm sure this other company's lobbyists were up there pushing for it too. That's just the way it works. So, but he didn't mention that. So that kind of irked me. I had actually dropped this issue as part of my letter, but this popped up on the radar, so it was definitely worth mentioning and presenting to the subscribers.
You have a question about Senator McCain that has come in. You want to take it?
Sure.
Paul is upstate New York, and he said, what, in your opinion, is the basis for McCain opposition to working with the Russian engines?
Because he believes that the purchase of Russian engines supports their military industrial complex financially. That may be his original problem with the RD-180 back a couple years ago was that it basically supported Putin and his cronies financially, and that was kind of disproven that they don't benefit directly from it. But now the comment is, you know, his complaint is that it benefits their military-industrial complex. And that might be so to a certain extent, but essentially what the senator wants to do is put us in a position where the only other vehicle available would be the Falcon 9 or the Delta 4. And if it's going to be a purely cost-basis competition, SpaceX is going to win every time. So I think he has a problem. He doesn't like Russia. I'll really put this more accurately. He hates Russia. He hates them with a passion, and he doesn't make that hatred very, he doesn't hide it. It's very visceral, my take is, like, you know what, this is an uncomfortable position we've been put in by policymakers 20-odd years ago, but now if we decide to drop it all of a sudden, just because it makes us feel better, we're just going to end up cutting off our nose to spite our face. Because that engine, we rely on that. The Atlas V is a workhorse, And now, of course, Orbital is using a variant of the RD-180 for their Antares rocket as well, which supply, and the kicker is, if those engines were banned for NASA flights, that means there would be only one game in town for resupply missions to the International Space Station as well.
Does McCain have a lot of support on his side?
No, he didn't have enough support, and you know, basically the amendment passed to actually clarify that language to make sure it couldn't be used in that way. But I thought this was very interesting to bring up because it just shows that, you know, Senator McCain is out there constantly looking for avenues to, you know, kind of short-circuit the whole RD-180 debacle thing. So it's still an active issue. He's out there looking for ways to do it roundabout. Even the direct approach just doesn't work anymore. He's lost a lot of support. One of his biggest supporters is Senator Bill Nelson. Actually, I think it was last year, in the current and in last year's NDAA, basically forged the compromise that, you know, allowed the military to continue using them for national security flights up to a certain year. So he's out of there. Jeff Sessions is now Attorney General, so he's not in there. Kelly Ayotte, who was a New Hampshire senator, who was a big supporter, and I had a few long conversations with her staff about this issue. She lost her reelection bid to Senator Hassan, so she's no longer an ally. So he's lost a lot of support in the Senate to actually, you know, ban these engines for their use, except for the point where they're actually, you know, going to be phased out for military use in the next few years.
Interesting. You also had an article about modernizing space laws. So what's that all about?
Yeah, that was kind of my, well, I won't call it a rant, but that was just kind of things that were on my mind about this whole, where we've been on this big kick for the past year about modernizing space law, and we're listening, you know, we're kind of looking at, you know, the Outer Space Treaty in ways that I don't think it was meant to be looked at. And I think we're so concerned about modernizing space law that we're not looking at what the fundamental ramifications are going to be to international law. I'm huge on international law, just because let me put it this way: if the international law was a body of water, dropping a rock and custom or an action by, say, the United States, say changing these commercial space law, was a rock. There's no telling on what's going to happen. You can throw that rock in, and it might make a small splash and just a few ripples that aren't going to bother you. On the other hand, the body of water could be a mud puddle standing in front of you, and say a new commercial space law could be a big flat rock. And if you drop it in there, when you're standing right in front of it, it's going to splatter all in your face. International law is a very, very funny thing, and we are in. Such a dynamic, especially with space-related stuff, that our actions and our prestige in outer space can actually have effects on it, on the way international law is interpreted when it comes to outer space. So we gotta think it through. In other words, before we do an action, we gotta think through: is this something we want to do? Is this going to have ramifications down in the long term? And how will our geopolitical rivals take advantage of our interpretations and use it against us down the road? I mean, I think those are fundamental questions. I don't know if they've always been asked, because we tend to be very short-sighted on, we want, quote, less regulation and less burdensome regulatory system for commercial space providers, so we can go out there and make a lot of money.
You have another email that I'll get in before we take a break at the top of the hour. So Ben is in Denver, and he says, why do we have to embolden international law over U.S. law? Why should it take precedence over what we decide to do? Why can't we just deal with U.S. law and let it handle space for us?
Well, the bottom line is we can, you know, we don't put it above our law, but we got to take it in international law into consideration when we make laws that are going to affect international obligations like the Outer Space Treaty. In other words, we like this law that we talked about before, this Commerce Act. I mean, essentially, this could affect the way we are interpreting certain provisions of the Outer Space Treaty, and that could change, ripples throughout the whole framework of international space law, including other countries and how other countries actually deal with space, to a sense that may actually hurt us in the past. So, in other words, you got to sit down and kind of do a Great Karnak in a sense and think, what's this going to do? You know, take the envelope, put it to your head, and trying to figure out if we pass this law and we promote this at the international level, is this going to come back and bite us in the future? It's hard to say sometimes, because sometimes it may not, but in other times it very well could. Yeah, what I'm saying is you got to sit down and have the intellectual exercise first and debate it and look at it and at least take it into consideration. I don't think a lot of, you know, what's happening right now in the House and the Senate, I don't think they're doing that. I mean, Senator Cruz is a very intelligent guy, but I don't think he understands, you know, the nuances and the and the responsiveness or the reaction, the reactionary characteristics that international law can have based on a law passed in the United States that affects a treaty, an international treaty obligation.
Or maybe they don't care.
That's a possibility, too.
All right. We are at the top of the hour, which would be halfway if we're doing a two-hour show, listeners. So we are going to take a pause in just a minute. And we will take more of your questions in the second period. And hopefully some of you will call us. I know you're not at work.
Mm-hmm.
So make that.
Please call.
Yeah, make that phone ring, or you're stuck listening to me for 2 hours, and I know you don't want to do that. So we'll be back in about 3 minutes with Michael Listener. So don't go anywhere. And again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. I do answer the phone during the break. And email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Coming right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody, to part two of our Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and our guest today is Michael Listener. We have a couple of sponsors that we want to thank for being with us on this segment. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and they are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then AIAA is a sponsor. That's the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries and about 95 corporate members. They are busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, increasing our knowledge of the universe, and bringing the world together. Go to some of their meetings, their conferences. Join them. Visit their website, AIAA.org. I'm in the process of making my reservations for Space 2017 in Orlando, and then a little couple of days of R&R down at the Cape. So if you're going to be there, let me know, and hopefully we can connect. But that's Space 2017 for AIAA in Orlando, and hopefully many of you listening will decide to go. Our guest today is none other than noted space attorney Michael Listener, who is sort of giving us a rundown on what's pending in legislation, what our lovable Congress is up to and doing, and, of course, some other things. And we have some emails that have come in from you during the break. Michael, do you want to resume your discussion or field the emails first?
No, let's do emails. Emails are great. It'd be great, but if we got a phone call.
Okay, and, yeah, it would be great. Nobody's working today, so 1-866-687-7223. And our line is clear, and if you call, you'll get right through. So Adrian in San Diego says, with the presumed advent of an increasingly advanced AI presence being applied to autonomous vehicles, including those possibly utilized for future space development, mining, construction, and exploration, what kind of national or global applicable laws do you think will be enacted to regulate AI operations? These could apply to potential AI claims for space object and or resource ownership and for any liabilities to any outer space or terrestrial outcomes due to AI actions. And it's signed by Adrian.
Oh, God, I don't know. That's a whole different bailiwick. That's a whole different area. It's kind of not my bailiwick. I presume they'll take up the problem once, once AR starts becoming more prominent, but hopefully before that we have Skynet or Terminators walking around.
Have you ever seen any proposed regulations that touch on AI for space or anything like that?
I haven't. I haven't heard anything about it. I think it's one of those things that people think, well, it's, you know, figure it's, you know, far enough down in the future that we'll deal with it later because there's so much on, you know, the plate right now that, it's something that we'll deal with later when it materializes.
Well, it is materializing slowly but surely. But
I've played with very rudimentary AIs for PCs and stuff like that, or that are actually web based. But nothing of the sophistication that we see in Hollywood.
Okay, so Adrian, save your question and ask it on a space show 7 years from now. Okay, I'm assuming I'll still be doing this in 7 years, and maybe that'll be a good time frame. You have a question from Jody, who is in Silicon Valley. Two questions for you. Many VC firms, that's venture capital people, are heavily funded by overseas investors. Do you think we should have a federal policy and associated organization budget, etc., that keeps leading-edge space tech, parentheses startups, funded within the U.S.? What steps could be implemented? And then she wants to know if you can comment on the NOAA language and efforts to in the House to stand up to Space Corps under the Air Force.
Okay, I think ITAR might actually touch on space tech where it actually deals with rockets. So there might, I can't be certain. That would actually be a question for the State Department, for their division that actually does that. But ITAR may actually deal with overseas funding of, say, rocket engines or other things that were on the munitions list. But otherwise, boy, I don't know. Because that's, should we have a law? I think there are certain countries that maybe we shouldn't accept funding from, like, people that, who are geopolitical rivals. We don't want them investing in our industry or having a stake in that, in our industry or our technology, especially if it's an equity stake, because that could be bad and detrimental. It could implicate, certain critical sensitive technologies. So I guess my answer is yes and no. Yes, we should. But on the other hand, we shouldn't make it so restrictive that we actually, discourage investment from traditional geopolitical allies flowing into these new technologies.
I can tell you that at the New Space Conference, their structure for the 3 days was one panel after another with keynoters scattered in between. And most of these panels were entrepreneurial business people from the Valley and San Francisco, South of Market, maybe a little up towards Seattle, maybe a couple of other places, but predominantly Northern California, San Jose, the Valley, and San Francisco. And some of them do get funding from foreign sources, most of them are doing some kind of imaging or satellite type of business or something like that. They do have, foreign investors, and they are getting money from foreign things, and foreigners do invest in these companies. Now, I don't know what the rules are. I'm thinking back to when Virgin America was trying to get its first license to fly commercial aviation services in America, and it was delayed incredibly because Branson could not own the controlling amount of stock, so they had to spin it off and find a way for Branson to own less than, I guess, 45% or something like that. And when Virgin was sold or merged into Alaska Airlines last year, the Virgin customers were all PO'd about it, and they asked Branson why he allowed that, and he said he didn't want them to do it, but he was not allowed to have controlling stock in the U.S. because of U.S. laws, so he did not own enough stock, even though he created the whole thing, to stop it from happening. So there are laws about it, but I don't know what they are.
And I think when it comes to critical technologies like rocket engine technology and guidance and things like that, there ITAR might actually address that.
Well,
I'm not an ITAR expert, so that would have to be verified with the State Department.
Right, and when X-Corp took in foreign money from Holland and I think it was Curaçao because they were going to launch from Curaçao or some other place down there, they put firewalls in place so the foreign investors could invest in the company, but there was no possible way any of the technology could be shared or viewed or seen or dealt with by the foreign investors. So they had they had to design a firewall system to, you know, to kind of keep part of the company U.S. eyes only, but yet the money could come in to benefit every bit of the company.
And I think that works for American companies that want to invest in foreign technology. I think I remember a few years ago you had the engineer who's working on the reaction engines for Skylon, and I think I asked him the question about foreign American investment in that, and I think he made the comment that ITAR, that implicates ITAR, and there was certain restrictions on that investment because going out of the United States for other technologies as well.
The other part of her comment is NOAA language in the Space Corps and the Air Force.
Yeah, that's the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that was just passed by the House House Armed Services Committee, and this is the Space Corps debate. Basically, what the House Armed Services Committee wants to do is create they want to splinter off a group from the Air Force that deals with space, with satellites and control of satellites and such, and space technology development, and create its own branch of the service that would be under the Air Force, kind of like the Marine Corps is part of the Navy.
Navy, yeah.
But it would also give the Space Corps a seat on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You know what? I came when the idea was originally proposed. I was pretty apoplectic about it. I really didn't like it. I talked to a few people that I really trust and I really respect their opinion, and I upgraded from I don't support it to I'm keeping an open mind about it because I like to see how it develops. I mean, it all depends on what the reason for doing this is. Are we doing this because Russia and China have a version of a space corps to deal with space environment, or is there really is the need that legitimate in order to have space in a separate service that gets its own funding that doesn't fall under the general Air Force under the Air Force budget itself? I don't know. I'm going to watch it as it develops. I know, like I said, the House Armed Services Committee approved it, so it's going to go to the full House for a vote on the 2018 NDAA. And the Senate's got to reconcile it, too, and agree to it to get it into the final NDAA. So I'm keeping an open mind about it, and this is based on conversations I've had with some people that I hold great respect for.
Now, this is kind of a little bit opposite from what the Secretary of the Air Force said at those congressional hearings.
Oh, yeah, they they were absolutely against it, and the general with her, General Goldstein, I believe, they were absolutely against it.
They don't want to put any resources
into
it or
anything. The overhead, the bureaucracy,
yeah.
and the money that's going to have to go into creating the whole separate force. So that is a consideration, too. But like I said, I don't know the full story. I'm sure there's more in the back channels than what we're reading in the media and what's being promoted at these public hearings. So, like I said, I'm keeping an open mind about it, and that's the best I can do at this point about my opinion on the Space Corps.
I like the idea of a Space Corps ever since I talked to Jim Armour when he was a general in the Air Force about it many, many years ago, and I've done many other shows about it, the latest with retired Colonel Coyote Smith. With his latest iteration of it. I'm supportive of it, depending on how they work out the bureaucracy of it, because they could absolutely ruin it if, you know,
well,
with what they do.
He's very intelligent, but you know, like I and but there are other people that I've discussed. He's one person that I respect and that I take into consideration. There's another gentleman who I've talked to who has who's involved in that who was involved in that segment of the Air Force and says this is probably this is something that's really needed. And of course I talked to somebody last Sunday too who basically said the same thing. So like I said, I'm keeping an open mind about it. I'm going to watch and see how it develops. I hate making rash choices. I kind of made a rash choice by being against it to begin with. I think being in the middle right now and just watching and see how things unfold is the best approach to take right now, Jody.
I'm curious if you know or any listeners know, and I don't even know if this is relevant, but I'd like to know the history of how the Coast Guard was created and if there was competition in creating the Coast Guard with the Navy, for example. I don't know the history of it. I should. But I'm wondering if there was some kind of similar, maybe military service rivalry. We don't need a Coast Guard. The Navy can handle this. Or if the Coast Guard came before the Navy. I don't know the history of it. Do you?
I don't. But I really like Jody's question. I mean, actually, two very good questions, and I think they're really relevant and something that these are the intricacies that we talked about at the beginning of the show, the fundamentals that are important to discuss. It isn't just it is, and I've said this before on your show. It isn't build rocket, push button, watch and applaud when it goes up, or cry when it fails like it did in China today. These are the fundamentals before you get to the push button stage.
Do you hear on the international side about the U.S. creating a space guard? Have you heard international opposition or support to it?
I haven't heard a word. Now I know both China and Russia, the People's Liberation Army and the Russian forces, have splintered off and created their own segments of the military that deal specifically with space systems. On the Chinese side, it's more of a support role in that they deal with all the infrastructure in order to keep to supply the PLA with the necessary resources to perform their duties, space resources to perform their duties. And Russia is kind of similar in their structure, is kind of similar, which is why I kind of said with the Space Corps thing, this would be a great thing if it isn't politically motivated, saying, they have it too. Well, since they have it, we need it. So if it's thought through, if it's done correctly, this will probably work out to be a good idea. The problem is, if it's done incorrectly and haphazardly, it could be a big bureaucratic disaster.
A couple of quick announcements, listeners, just in keeping with what Michael said, and I should have said it up front. The second attempt for China to launch a Long March 5 did fail today, and you can see pictures of it and read about it on the net if you're so inclined to do that. And then today is a very special day, Michael, because it is World UFO Day. I just thought I'd throw that out for you.
Oh, yeah. I just absolutely have that on my calendar. Between Asteroid Day and World UFO Day, I just have those right on my calendar. I look forward to them every year.
The thing about Asteroid Day is the NASA Planetary Defense Office has actually made PR statements and other things in support of and about certain asteroid things that are happening and NEOs that are happening. So they do kind of take it seriously. And as a result of this, Hotel Mars is focusing on some of the NEO and asteroid developments and programs and what's been happening about close encounters with David Grinspoon. And we've invited the head of Planetary Defense to come on. Not sure that he will be able to do it. But there's at least a little sidebar to Asteroid Day that, mm-hmm. that has a credibility and a seriousness to it rather than worshiping asteroids. But, of course, World UFO Day, man, that's the most serious holiday of the year. That surplants July 4th for me.
Basically, when people start talking about UFOs, I really say, you know what, I really have no comment.
I'm surprised it's not listed on my iPhone calendar as a default, like July 4th. Come on, Apple, get with it.
One day I look forward to it, and I really should put this day on my calendar, is National Coffee Day, because I can go out. I usually make the rounds to Dunkin' Donuts, Cumberland Farms, and several other shops and get my free coffee.
They give free coffee away on National Coffee Day?
What's that?
They give free coffee away on National Coffee Day.
Damn right. I can get a coupon right on my iPhone. One of the best uses my iPhone ever gave me was be able to put a coupon on it to go up and cash out for a free cup of coffee at Cumberland Farms.
So we don't have that in California, but I'm aware of Dunkin' Donuts, but we don't have that out here either. Anyway, no sense to give them sponsor time when they don't sponsor me. To hell with them. Listeners, you can still call us 1-866-687-7223, and you can still email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com or post on the Space Show blog. Mike,
and I'm lamenting you guys, because we talked about this earlier. You said at least one of you were going to call in.
Yeah, well, they cowered out with the power.
Well, you know
telephone.
What? I'm not going to go to that extreme, but come on, guys, I'm not going to bite.
What else is, I mean, you've got a couple, I mean, you got 60-something pages here of really cool things that are happening. And let's turn to international. I mentioned the fact that the Azores and Luxembourg were at the New Space Conference, but that's just a drop in the bucket of what's going on these days. And somebody is calling you.
Cool.
You want to take the call first?
Yeah, let's do the call.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
My name is Dan Skate. I'm in Columbia, Maryland.
Thank you for calling, Dan.
Hey, did you get my email the other day about a call tomorrow afternoon?
I did, in fact.
Cool. Well, let's firm up with that, you know, later on today when you're available to have a chat.
What's on your mind, Dan?
Well, what was on my mind, I guess, ties in a little bit to your Space Corps discussion, and that is exactly the Space Enterprise Consortium. Because I think that fundamentally, this use of OTAs is really the only way that a Space Corps can maintain parity or supremacy over any adversaries. Obviously, our traditional methods of acquisition just don't work. And I think the folks in Silicon Valley have shown that to us over and over again.
Hey Dan, for the audience and a little bit for myself too, could you explain about this consortium a little bit, please?
Sure. So Air Force Space Command Space and Missile Systems Center has put out a request for proposal to develop a space enterprise consortium using an instrument for contracting, which is called an OTA, or an Other Transaction Authority. And basically what this says is it's a way for the government to very rapidly purchase prototypes. And a prototype can be anything from a piece of hardware to software to algorithms. It's a pretty broad definition. And the members of a given consortium under a given OTA can respond to the government's different requests and needs and gaps that they're trying to fill. And typically it's done very efficiently with a short white paper, and then the government will review those white papers and select one or two or even three different alternatives, and they can very quickly, and by very quickly I mean within, let's say, 90 to 120 days, fund the development of a given prototype, and the payment goes out, and I should back up a little bit and say they're not FAR-based. So they're not based on the federal acquisition regulations. So they're relieved of a lot of the things that put up barriers of entry, particularly to new technology and smaller businesses, but even to some larger businesses. And the bottom line is it's a way for the government to get the best ideas, to very quickly execute them. And if it works, the way that NDAA 2016 changed these OTAs, which actually have been around for a long time, was that they allow you then to take that successful prototype that meets the needs of the government and convert it into a FAR-based production contract without need for any further competition. So if you needed 150 of the widgets you could go ahead and order it and have them built and pay for it. And, you know, we have now just jumped, we've leapfrogged, I should say, the old method of doing business. And I think that, again, this is going to be a key differentiator for a future Space Corps, and even the Air Force if the Space Corps idea ends up not happening.
That's very interesting. I'm looking forward to talking with you tomorrow afternoon more about that. But have you heard about that? Ever heard about that, David?
No, I've not heard a word about it.
Yeah, you know, okay, I'm going to put Dan on the spot. But you know what? That might make a great space show. But I'm just, you know, that's up to you too.
Dan, are you in the Air Force, Dan?
So I'm retired from the Air Force.
Okay.
And I work for the university's Space Research Association, which is a nonprofit that was formed by the National Academies of Science and NASA to bring academia, industry, and the government together to solve the tough problems of space science and technology development.
Well, so that broader topic would be really interesting. Can you email me so I can get your contact information to get a hold of you?
I sure can. No problem.
I would appreciate that.
But I agree with Dan, because if you're going to take this, what I consider a very radical step of creating a separate space force, you can't strangle it with the same type of contracting requirements for new technologies in order to perform their mission. So what Dan is talking about would dovetail perfectly with a new Space Corps, and if both those could be pulled off at the same time, things would be pretty cool.
Okay.
All right.
Dan, anything else?
No, this is going to be complex. But I think, to be honest, what the Air Force has unfortunately shown time and time again is their inability to follow through on promises of making space a priority. It's why I think Congressman Rogers was so frustrated and has been able to successfully where the Republicans and the Democrats are a bipartisan manner, been able to push this through, because it was a 100% voice vote on the Strategic Armed Forces Subcommittee, and then on the Armed Forces Committee, there was a little bit of contention. One of the members of Congress, who I guess was a retired Air Force colonel, said she had never heard of it, which I kind of thought was not very promising on her part, because she really should have been paying attention, because the rest of us knew this was going on. So I think it's really important. I think the country needs it. I don't think it's going to need to create a new bureaucracy, because, to be honest, you could take Air Force Space Command, take generals out of the command building in Colorado Springs, move them to the Pentagon, turn their deputies into their directorates, and you've got, you know, just add water and you have a Space Corps. I mean, I know I'm simplifying it tremendously, but it can be done.
No, I like that idea. You know what your discussion on that between the consortium and what you had to say about the Space Corps. I'm moving more from the keeping an open mind to actually, you know, this will be a really good idea.
I want to know what their uniforms are going to look like.
I'm thinking, you know, Jonathan Frakes has shown us what they could look like.
Right.
Hey, so long as it's a Buzz Lightyear type uniform, I'll be pretty good with it.
Dan, contact me. Send me your information via email, and I'll get back to you in a day or two.
I'll get you his email address so you can contact him directly later on today,
okay.
Dan.
Thank you, guys.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan.
Right.
Thanks, Dan.
Right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So
that was a pretty cool phone call.
So callers, you're free to use the phone again, 1-866-687-7223. I know you want to work in and talk about, international law perspectives and stuff. You want to try it and see if the phone, before the phone rings or another email comes in?
Okay, yeah. One thing that's going on is Australia. Australia's had a Space Act for a long time, for quite a few number of years, and it actually takes into effect, you know, some commercial activities. But over the past year, they've actually been looking at it again, and, you know, look, and going out to industry and academia and asking, what's wrong, you know, what's your experience of this? What's wrong with it? What do we need to improve? So I really found it, I actually got the, you know, the kind of the results of the survey, and I was going to write about it. And I said, you know what? I'm not Australian. I don't have the proper perspective to write something about this for my briefing letter, which is important. It's important to get across my subscribers. So I'm going to give a big shout out to Dr. Alice Gorman, Dr. Space Junk on Twitter, if you don't follow her. And I just sent her an email. I said, hey, would you be, because she's on a committee that basically is helping to reevaluate this particular law. And I asked her, hey, would you mind doing me like an in her word write up on your perspective? Because one, you're Australian. Two, you're not a lawyer. And I'd really love a non-lawyer's perspective. She absolutely agreed to it. She was excited and really to do it, and she did an excellent job. I didn't have to change anything. I just pasted it right into the document. But basically, for the fundamental crux of Alice's short brief essay was that basically, you know, they're looking at the issues of, you know, how they can improve the law and make it more friendly for private industry to actually, you know, bring it about. And when I actually looked through the survey results, you know, of all the industry and academia that they asked questions, that the government asked questions of, I said, you know what, the questions and concerns that they have with it, they aren't that much different from what the, you know, the questions and concerns are here that the United States had during the teething years of, you know, basically the FAA, the current regulatory, I say regulation with a very light touch because there aren't a lot of regulations, but the current legal structure right now in the United States. So my impetus, even though it is Australia, and it's in a kind of a different culture, their experiences with their law are, the experiences, whether good or bad, are kind of similar to what the U.S. has been having. So this is pretty much, you know, our universal thing. But Australia is actively saying, you know what, we don't even have space agency. I know Alice has been one of the people actually pushing the creation of an Australian space agency, which might be a surprise announcement. I know they're hosting the International Astronautical convention in Adelaide this September. There has been a rumor that they may actually make an announcement about the creation of an Australian space agency then. That's the rumor I heard. But Australia, keep an eye on them. They're very well situated about what's, you know, the importance of space and Australia's role in space. And this is a law that they're working on. And I'm super appreciative to Alice for, you know, giving her and my subscribers perspective on that, because I'm an American. I have my own perspective, but it's good to have the perspective of somebody who's there, who's doing it, and somebody who's not a lawyer.
Okay. You have another caller on hold. You ready to take it?
Let's do it.
And by the way, listeners, Alice has been a guest on the show several times. She's a great guest, so you might want to go pick up her programs. Just use the search box in the upper right hand corner for her name, and you can pick up her shows. I think she was on either earlier this year or later last year. I don't recall exactly.
She was on twice.
Yeah, she's been on. Well, I think she's been on three times, hasn't she? Or is it just twice?
I think it's twice.
And she will be on again. She's a great guest. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. Hi, Michael. This is Carl Hoos.
Hi, Carl.
From Balt Enterprises. I'm in the great state of Maine.
Carl.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, you know who this is, David.
Yeah, I've been waiting to hear from you guys after the Space Symposium and my emails to you to get you on a show.
You just have to wait for us to thaw out a little bit. We're starting to enjoy the summer weather here, and so we're just getting the last bit of frost out of our ears. So give us time. We'll get on there.
Okay, because I'm still interested for sure.
So are we.
What's on your mind for today?
Well, Michael, I was listening to the show the whole time, and I wanted to get some more thoughts on the spaceports that are popping up around the country here. And granted, I mean, it's just incredible the amount of space activity, new commercial space activity going around the globe. Now we have a number of these spaceports that are popping up in the U.S. Granted, they're kind of laying the foundation for what even the FAA is hoping for, you know, a lot more launches from the U.S. actually George Neal had mentioned to me. They'd like to see space launches almost as prevalent as aircraft takeoff and landing. So I think we've got a ways to get to that point. But right now, there are a lot of spaceports that are popping up around the country. I'm not quite sure how they're getting the revenue. I know there's a number of states that are putting quite a bit of money into these facilities. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about the policies that are going into place when we do start having launch vehicles popping up around the country. Are the policies that are going in place for these launches going to inhibit a big commercial growth in these launches in the U.S. from what you see?
I don't think it's so much inhibiting it. I think it's actually encouraging it and enabling it. It's really at two levels right now. First, the federal laws basically enable the states to come down and say, we want, you know, to permit these actual spaceports to be constructed. Some of them are built from the ground up, like the one in New Mexico, Spaceport America, which is struggling right now because they don't have a lot of activity out there. But other ones, like the airport in Denver I mentioned earlier in the show, are basically augmenting a spaceport license onto an existing airport. So the state, it really boils a lot down to state and local politics and policy. For example, let's just say I wanted to open a spaceport here in New Hampshire. Probably never going to happen, but let's use it as a good example. I would have to convince my legislature, you know what, we need a spaceport because this is growing and technology is enabling rockets to launch from sites that don't need facilities like Cape Canaveral. But then I got to convince them to actually, you know, allow the FAA to go forward with it. And then I got to say, you know what? There are certain liabilities, legal liabilities. We got to pass these laws in order to limit the liability of these operators. So that's a matter of pushing it through the state legislature. It boils down to local politics, and you're going to have a lot of different, you know, lobbies against it, you know, maybe from lawyers' lobby to environmental groups. I know in Georgia right now, with their spaceport that they want to put together, one of the biggest things is the environmental impact that a spaceport will have. But if you have an existing facility already, you can always make the argument, you know what, this facility is always existing as an airport, or, you know, has an airport license. It's just another thing. It really isn't going to hurt the environment to augment a spaceport license onto it. So I think the federal policies are very positive there. It's just the local policies. But then when you actually get launching, then you got to apply for launch licenses through the FAA. And, you know, that usually takes several months to maybe up to a year, depending on what you're launching. And, of course, that law that I mentioned earlier might actually streamline that a little bit. But I think this thing will move along as more enabling technologies come along. And I hope you don't mind. I'm just going to say a little bit about Carl, the company, Vault, that Carl mentioned. I didn't realize that I had a company about 20 miles away from me, just across the border in Maine, that was actually working on a rocket that combined hypersonics. And I was just tickled pink about it. I mean, I was like, I can't believe it. You know, there's actually space-related life here in New England and right near me. And I actually had lunch with one of his business, Carl's business associates, Elise McGill, last time, and we talked a lot about it, and she explained some things about their organization. And I think, you know, in essence, and I won't steal any thunder from a show that's coming, you know, that Carl and Elise might do down the road here, but I think the technology Vault is developing is going to be one of those enablers that's going to say, take, you know, an old Air Force base or an old facility and be able to augment a spaceport on there and do launches from New England for small sats. And I mentioned how small sats I see are really an up-and-coming thing and will be a real enabler for commercial space economically.
Yeah, that's what we were hoping. You have that exactly right, Michael. That's one of the reasons why we're kind of looking at all the spaceports around the country, too, because Vault is really on the far small end of the launch vehicles that are under development. So we're just talking a 25-kilogram payload, but the combination of high-speed air breathers and rockets really shrinks the size of the vehicle down. But one of the good things, and I know that some of the spaceports around the country only have horizontal takeoff capability, and Vault has the capability to be dropped from a plane as well as launched from land, mm-hmm. even at sea. So, you know, where some of those spaceport licenses are going, you know, we would be interested in working with those folks. I wasn't quite sure on whether or not, well, take for instance Colorado at Front Range, where they're looking at the license in Colorado. I wasn't sure if there was a restriction on where they actually drop that launch vehicle from within their license, or to just go to, you know, them taking off from Front Range and then they have to drop it somewhere out of state.
I think that's something they would supply their proposal to the FAA, and the FAA would look at that, and that would be part of the consideration, overflight and things like that. But if you have like an old Air Force base that's impressively in the middle of nowhere, you know, you have a lot more play. Again, it's all working through the system once you get to the point where, you know, you're actually promoting a spaceport, but you got to be able to have the capability your company is developing. You've got to be able to go to a state like the state of Maine or New Hampshire legislature and say, hey, we want to build a spaceport. We got this great rocket. We want to launch payloads. We know this old Air Force base or old facility that is hardly being used and be a great spot to do it. And oh, guess what? It'll bring jobs to the area, high tech jobs. So it's a political game as well as a legal game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we're finding. I mean, we've been working in the government sector for quite a bit. The commercial side is really new to us, but it's got some really unique opportunities for us with combining, you know, doing this kind of combined propulsion system for a launch vehicle. But it's a whole new ball game, really, when you're talking about working the political side in order to get the commercial development up and running. So we're trying to work both. And, you know, that kind of brings me to another question, too. It seems like on the commercial space efforts that are going on, they're heating up quite a bit. It looks like DOD is kind of taking a back seat on the launch side. They're just, you know, they have the large launch vehicle. Mm-hmm. However, if you start getting a lot of small launches up with a lot more, opportunities to go in different orbits, a lot more constellations, you see the power of the small satellites. Do you see DOD stepping in and saying, "Hey, this is getting to be a threat to our our space"?
I think they're going to see it as an opportunity. There's a congressman. I've actually had some dealings with him. Really great. I have the email address of one of the staffers, and we talk about space related stuff. He created this thing called the American Space Renaissance Act a couple of years ago. And one of the things, you've heard of the Venture Class Launch Systems?
Yes.
And basically that's a NASA that is a NASA program, and there's a bunch of contractors who have become NASA venture class suppliers, and it deals with launching small sats. In the American Space Renaissance Act, in the National Security section, Representative Bridenstine wanted to transfer one of the Pentagon to adopt a venture class program for small sats for DOD. So that didn't get a lot of traction. He's supposed to reintroduce it this year at some point, and I'm sure it'll have that provision in there. But I mean, at least on the congressional side, they're looking at, you know what, the idea of small sat launch capabilities for NASA is a good thing, but it'd also be a good thing for DOD as well. So I don't see it as a threat to their launch system. I see it as an opportunity to augment their current launch systems that they already depend upon.
I kind of agree, which kind of made it a little bit weird why DOD wasn't getting in the game with NASA. You know, because I didn't know if they, I mean, granted, when General Hyten's talking about small satellites and the opportunities that, you know, from a national security standpoint, the satellites being much smaller, you know, not that they can get everything they can out of the big satellites, but they have other capabilities that don't quite exist in the small sat arena yet, but they're on their way. And
right.
Why DoD doesn't step into the launch side a little bit more is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and like I said, I think Congress is kind of moving that way, and I think they're beginning to realize it as well, which is why. But you know, it's a matter of the availability of launch systems, and there aren't a lot of available launch systems. But I mean, I sound like I'm promoting your product, your company.
Yeah.
but from what I've seen,
that's
from
right,
my,
Michael. Go ahead.
And looking at your website and everything, but you know, gather what you're proposing would be a pretty low cost system. Not only DoD purposes, but for academia, for commercial, for CubeSats. I mean, it's what I call an enabling technology. And if you have the technology, it's a lot easier to actually get the local governments to get on board with it, especially if it's going to create jobs.
Yeah, and that's something that Maine needs. And I think it's actually we were talking with some other folks about this in Maine, and we actually. We've conducted flight tests in Maine already, suborbital, of course, but in the development of the system. And it's interesting because the FAA, when we had talked with them about doing suborbital flight testing, they looked at Vault and said, well, geez, because of this, you don't have the liquid oxygen on board like other rockets, it's much safer. And we consider giving you a launch license to orbit either out of the northern part of the state of Maine where there's very low population density or on the coast of Maine. And if you pull up your Google Earth and you look at the coast of Maine, you can get direct access to polar orbits, which would be essentially the only one on the East Coast.
Right. Right. I mean, like I said, I think, it's technology that really technology is a driver for legislation like this. And I think when, if you have something solid like this, it makes selling the case a lot easier, both politically and legally, too. So, I mean, and since you've already worked with the FAA, they love the technology. And just for your listeners so you understand, their technology, I believe, uses a ramjet concept, I believe, to get it up to speed, to get it into orbit. I got to get over to your lab, and I definitely want to be there when you start flying again, test flights. I want to see one. They have a pretty innovative setup, and impressed the hell out of me. Just talking with Elise and what I've read. David, I know we kind of left out of this conversation.
No, that's okay. I'm kind of trying to wonder if you're at a construction site or a zoo, given all the background noise we're hearing.
Well, was that directed at me, David?
Yes. Because Michael has no background noise.
I'm sorry. It's Sunday, so I've got my spot in the local coffee shop.
Ah.
So sorry. I've got headphones on, so I can hear you guys perfect.
Well, hey, can Carl give the website out to your listeners for his company just so they can go take a look for themselves?
Only if he promises to get back to me with the lease and schedule the damn show we've been talking about since February.
We'll definitely do that within the next 2 months. How's that, David?
The next 2 months. Okay.
Do you have time the next month?
Yeah, whenever you want. We'll make time because we're big on hypersonics on this show. So we want to hear from you.
Okay. Sure. Well, we'll schedule for this month.
So
I'll get in touch with you.
So get in touch with me, and I'll send you your website first.
And actually, David, I'll send it to you. And if you wouldn't mind posting it to the blog, that would be pretty awesome.
Well, I've got his website here. It's just Vault Enterprises, vault-ent.com, spelled V-A-L-T. So if anybody wants to look it up, but I'll put it in the.
It's just a starter website, but it'll kind of give you the concept of what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, and I'll put it in the archives as well too.
And we're having this conversation, and and Lisa's going nuts on my texting here. She's very happy right now, so.
Well, tell her we're glad she's happy.
I really appreciate you calling. I know I kind of put Elise on the spot this afternoon saying, hey, call. But I'm really glad you called because, we got to meet very soon. Anyway.
We're very close, and there's going to be a lot more activity happening here in Maine. So
Are you guys planning to maybe be at the AIAA gig in Orlando in September?
Definitely if we can work it into our schedule, we'll definitely try and get down there.
If you do, make sure you let me know. I'd love to connect with you guys again.
Yep. Well, we'll talk this month anyways and try and set something up.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Sounds good.
And,
thanks for calling,
Carl.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye.
I wonder if that was a Dunkin' Donuts coffee shop. What do you think, Michael?
I have no idea.
It was really noisy, let me tell you.
Yeah, it was. I'm really glad he called. And I'll be honest, I kind of talked to Elise beforehand, saying, hey, it's, you know, we call in. And so this was kind of contrived in a little bit, but we needed some phone calls.
But listeners, as a way of background, Michael introduced me to Elise back in January or February, and we agreed to meet at the Space Foundation Symposium about their telling me what they were doing, because I'm really interested in hypersonic flight, and we've done a lot of shows on that in the past, even with people down in Australia. And so we met, Elise and Carl and I, in the Boeing Lounge at the Space Foundation Exhibit Hall. And then, of course, I followed it up, and I'm still waiting for the follow-up. So I guess this is the follow-up. But that's the origin of how I got into this. Michael introduced me to Elise because he knew of them and he knew of my interest in what they were doing. And they are doing really cool things. And they would be a great space show team to have on the program. And I'm looking forward to being able to introduce that to all of you, because I think you'll find also that they're doing really interesting things. So.
And by the way, Elise just texted, thank you, David, for giving the time to let Carl call in and talk about Volt.
Oh, well, that's what we're all about. Now, tell me when you guys want to be on the show, Elise. Get with it. Listeners, we do actually, we're coming up on 2 hours, Michael. What do you want to go over by very much? Do you have something compelling that you want to say? Do you want to sum it up?
With all technology going on, like what Carl is doing with Vault and Maine, whether it's SpaceX doing what they're doing, there's a lot of space activity in the technical side, but I want you to understand there's a lot going on in the policy and the legal side too. I'm just gonna make a shameless pitch for my briefing letter. This is the reason I created the Pressy, and it's just turned into something that I didn't expect it to. 61 pages for a quarterly issue is pretty, it wasn't what I expected when I originally started. So, but I get down and dirty, and I filter through things and try and give my subscribers an idea of what's going on there. And there's just so much out there, and I think 61 pages in a quarterly issue tells you there's a lot going on out there, and a lot of stuff didn't make the cut. So I want them to understand there's a lot going on under the scenes. When you see a rocket fly, understand there's a lot going on underneath versus in the legal and the policy environment. And, take a look at my newsletter, too. I try to make it affordable as possible. It's a lot of work for me, but I love it. There's a lot of people I want to thank, like Alice Gorman, like Chris Newman, who've contributed to it. Some of my Twitter followers who actually, provide information that sets me off for it. Space Watch ME, I want to give a big shout out to them, because I have an agreement where they republish some of my selected portions of my briefing letter. Both John Sheldon and Torsten Krennig, they're really great guys and been very supportive of the Pressy. So that's available. I'm sure David will post the website, the link to the website where you can, I'll actually give you a free issue if you want to look at it. I mean, I could talk for hours about what's going on. And even though the pitching letter is a bit shameless, I'm going to pitch it anyways and say, this is a great resource if you really want to know what's going on and you want a no-frills, no hyperbole look at what's really going on in the world of space law and policy.
And listeners, it is a very high-quality newsletter, and it does tell you what's going on the policy side and the space legislation and regulatory side. So if you have an interest in that, and you probably should, check it out, because I assure you, for every rocket launch that SpaceX makes, and by the way, they have one coming up later today, so good luck on your launch, SpaceX, but for any of these, there are a lot of policies and regulations and laws that we don't think about or even know that have made that launch possible. So this is a good way to stay informed in that area, and we thank Michael for coming back on the show and updating us on things.
Well, it's always glad, it's always good to be back here, David. I mean, I think we started this back in 2012, the first time I came on, and it's been quite a consistent thing. But I really support, and I want to commend David for what he's doing, because I know there's a lot of work involved in this. And yes, this gives me a lot of, yes, admittedly, this gives me a lot of exposure, but at the same time, I want to commend David for the work and the time that he puts into it. This is dedication, folks, what David does with the Space Show. And if you can support him by promoting it or, you know, whatever, do it, because it's well worth the effort.
Thank you, Michael. Listeners, that's going to be it. Michael will be back on again down the road in a couple weeks. We're not through with him yet for 2017. Everybody have a great holiday weekend, which I guess is really underway. We do have a show tomorrow on Mars rock geology, which should be pretty interesting, with Barry DeGorgio is back with us. And everybody, you know, keep looking up, but have a safe weekend, and don't burn yourselves on the barbecue. And again, a very happy birthday to Uncle Sam. And all of you come back tomorrow, then Hotel Mars, Friday and Sunday. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Michael Listener for being here, and those of you who emailed us and who called. Everybody have a great July 4th long holiday. Goodbye from the Space Show.